Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Now, the storms themselves, unfortunately, are not going to have a lot of rain, so there could be a good amount of dry lightning.
Firefighters prepare for lightning in the interior as fires burn throughout the state. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 30th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, as the Sullivan Arena shelter closes in Anchorage, people prepare to camp outside.
Being able to get it up and down from the tent, it's a struggle. And I cry every day.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Alaska's wildfire fighting preparedness has been raised to the highest level, 5. The designation reflects the number of large fires being fought and the limited availability of firefighting resources, and enables more firefighting resources to be brought to Alaska from outside. Alaska currently has 157 active wildfires, 19 of which are being fought. The 2 largest responses are on the 23,000-acre Clear Fire near Anderson and the 20,000-acre Minto Lakes Fire north of Fairbanks, where air and ground suppression and point protection efforts continue and evacuation orders are in effect for threatened areas. During a public meeting hosted by the Minto Lakes Fire Incident Management Team last night, Operations Manager Teo Fusco said efforts target protecting cabins along the Chattanooga River.
We currently have firefighters. We have 3 crews in there, multiple firefighters and pumps and boats working along this corridor, as well as aircraft.
He said the other big focus is on blocking the fire's path into neighborhoods to the northeast. The work is benefiting from burn scars and fire lines from the 2019 Shovel Creek and 2013 Hastings wildfires in the area. But Incident Commander Joel Delgado said resource availability has constrained operations.
There's a lot of fires across the state of Alaska. And it takes a long time to get crews up from the lower 48 here. So they are rolling in, and we have crews rolling in today, more tomorrow, so we'll have more resource availability for the fire.
Incident meteorologist Joe Gausward says the forecast is calling for lightning.
Now, the storms themselves, unfortunately, are not going to have a lot of rain. So there could be a good amount of dry lightning with these.
The thunderstorms are forecast to be followed by another stint of warm, dry weather. A burn ban on all types of open flame is scheduled to go into effect Friday at midnight. There are burn restrictions in other parts of the state, too, including in Anchorage and the Mat-Su. Also today, the Alaska State Fire Marshal's Office announced it's prohibiting the use of fireworks in much of the state until further notice due to hot and dry weather and the ongoing fire response going into the 4th of July weekend. The suspension is in effect until further notice in areas including Mat-Su, Kenai Peninsula, and the Fairbanks area. Anchorage officials shut down the city's largest homeless shelter today after more than 2 years of housing hundreds of people there each night. It was an emotional morning for those who had to pack up and move out of the Sullivan Arena. Some headed for hotel rooms, but as Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports, many grabbed a packaged breakfast and prepared to start camping outside.
Rose George is standing next to a pile of plastic totes on the steps of the Sullivan Arena early Thursday morning, writing on a pad of paper. It's a thank you note to the shelter staff. Leaving, she says, is bittersweet.
Honestly, it's a lot harder than I expected it to be. There's a lot of great staff and a lot of good people I met here, and a lot of memories and things that I learned that I'm going to take with me.
She says she's waiting on a taxi to take her to her new room at the Aviator Hotel, where dozens of Sullivan guests have moved over the past few weeks. but many others leaving the Sullivan on Thursday did not have an indoor place to go. There's not enough space at shelters or hotel rooms, so the city is busing people to a campground. Sean Shields says it feels like a betrayal.
He promised all these people housing or some way to get housing, and not to be bussed out of sight, out of people, so can nobody see him. You know, that's not right.
The closure of the Sullivan marks a milestone in the city's plan to transition to permanent shelters after 2 years of its pandemic response. But the phase down has been riddled with accusations of poor planning and bad communication. Advocates say there simply weren't enough free rooms in the city, which forced dozens of people to camp in tents. The Bronson administration recently repurposed a campground in East Anchorage to give people who are homeless a legal place to stay. Shields says his only option is to head to that campground, but he worries about the weather and bears.
I'm from Georgia, so I've been learning how to camp, you know, but I can just imagine, you know, what happens when it rains? You know, what happens when the first person gets mauled? This isn't protecting anybody.
Shields says he can't work because of a brain injury caused by a stroke. But even those with jobs like Billy Jens of Utqiagvik say the city's tight housing market makes finding an apartment hard.
We did try other places like Craigslist for apartments, Airbnb, but they're just a little bit more expensive because the summer rates are crazy.
Jens says he's also headed to the repurposed campground called Centennial Campground. He's sitting on a curb behind the Sullivan Arena with his bag stacked nearby around 9 in the morning. He's waiting for a white health department bus to take him. Officials say they've moved more than 70 people from the Sullivan to Centennial since late last week. Tucked in thick spruce trees beside the Glen Highway, the campground usually charges $25 a night, but those fees were waived for homeless campers beginning a week before. By mid-morning on Thursday, staff and volunteers were setting up tents for new arrivals. Campground staff say the site was already above capacity around noon, so some tents were staked in a common area. The influx of people posed its own set of challenges. David Neuner says in the few days since he's arrived, he's seen black and brown bears with cubs, and says one even entered a neighbor's tent. Officials promised to hand out bear-proof food containers. Some campers had hung bags of food from trees to keep them away from bears. Some of the campers said being in the woods was comfortable. Having security patrols means that they don't have to worry about leaving their things. There's bathrooms and trash service. James Keel says he was a big fan of the hot showers.
I hadn't taken a shower in, six, 7 days, you know, before I'd gotten here. And so it was amazing just having a shower.
But others say they aren't happy here. Sitting at a nearby picnic bench next to a folding walker, Margaret Chicklack said her back and leg problems means getting to a grocery store or bus can be challenging, not to mention staying in a tent. It's hard for her to get up in the morning. She's only sleeping on a camping pad.
Being able to get it up and down from the tent it's a struggle. And I cry every day, you know? I can't move around a lot like a normal person can.
She says she has to rely on her fiance to lift her up each morning and rely on volunteers to bring her food. She doesn't like depending on others, but without an apartment, she says it's her best option in Anchorage right now. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Lex Trinan.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a rare genetic mutation in Sitka's cat population.
It looks like she has thumbs. She has huge paws. She can pick up a blueberry with her hand.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If your business has the capability, skills, and experience to provide products and services to government agencies, it can be a long-term, positive, and rewarding relationship with the potential to be an important source of income. Alaska PTAC can help your business navigate the many regulations, laws, and procedures involved with government contracting. Go to ptacalaska.org to schedule your appointment with a contract specialist. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
Sea Alaska Corporation shareholders have voted to get rid of the blood quantum requirement for enrollment. The vote was tallied at the annual shareholders meeting in Juneau on June 25th. Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports.
The change means descendants of original shareholders no longer need to prove they have one-quarter Native blood to become a shareholder, which was a requirement set by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 1971.
It was super exciting to see the vote.
Angela Michaud is a corporation board member and was the first person to enroll after the vote. Previously, she had just one share gifted from her grandmother. This new enrollment gives her 100 more shares, which will last her lifetime. But she was most excited for her four children, who can also enroll when they come of age.
When my kids get 18, they'll also be a part of this. And so it means that that you're able to be part of it and that you're Native enough. It didn't matter that your parents or grandparents married somebody who wasn't Native. You're still Native.
ANCSA limited shares to those enrollees born by 1971. After that, descendants had to be gifted original shares or, starting in 2007, get a different class of shares known as descendant shares. But they still had to prove a quarter Native blood. Board President Joe Nelson says it's an issue he's heard a lot about from shareholders, which he understands personally as well. While he was an original shareholder, his sister born a few years later wasn't. He calls the 1971 ANCSA cutoff date arbitrary and the blood quantum requirement archaic.
The blood quantum issue itself continues to literally divide families pretty quickly, and within a few generations, the pool of eligible descendants would be dwindling.
Now, people just need to prove they are descended from an original shareholder through a birth certificate. Sea Alaska Corporation has 23,000 shareholders who are Thlinkit, Haida, and Tsimshian people with roots in Southeast Alaska. Many now live elsewhere. Not all of them agree with the change. 40% of shareholders did not support dropping the blood quantum requirement. Vicky Mata was one of them. She's a former Sea Alaska Communications vice president. She says the change devalues shareholders' dividends and voting power.
If you add more shareholders, then the voting strength of the current shareholders is diluted.
Mata is an administrator of the social media group Shareholders of Sea Alaska that includes 6,000 members. She says many dissenters agreed that the blood quantum issue needed to be talked about, but she says the vote was rushed, giving shareholders just 6 weeks to consider the question, and the timing was bad.
Food prices, gas prices, everything is hitting all at once. So every dollar counts when it comes to making ends meet, especially those on fixed income and our elders.
Sea Alaska shareholders are paid dividends twice a year. Original shares pay more than those allocated to descendants. That's due to a formula sharing natural resource earnings among regional Native corporations. The corporation predicts that approximately 15,000 shareholders over a 20-year period would be eligible to enroll with the loosened requirements. Sea Alaska Corporation is the third of Alaska's 12 regional Native corporations to eliminate the blood quantum requirement. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
After 2 years of volatility, including some of the lowest oil prices on record, Alaska's North Slope crude has been over $100 a barrel since March. High oil prices are associated with increased oil revenue and economic activity in the state, but how much do individual Alaskans feel those benefits? Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George spoke to state economist Sarah Teal to find out. Teal says the recent highs follow a long period of uncertainty in the industry.
Well, we have definitely seen those kinds of lows and those kinds of highs. In March, April of 2020, we saw prices plunge into the negative territory, and that was for a number of reasons. We had a price war that was going on between Russia and Saudi Arabia, and then we had that rapid drop in demand because we had people that were staying at home and enacting the mitigation tactics that we were using due to COVID. And then within two years, it shot up to well over $100, and then and now we're hitting $120. And that's just a massive increase in price, and it creates a lot of volatility.
And the most recent increase has also been influenced by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, correct?
Yes, we've seen a marked increase in oil prices since that happened.
As well as increased demand as the pandemic has kind of abated.
Exactly, at the same time. And then we also have been having supply bottlenecks. And so we have a disconnect between supply and demand. And so that's why we're seeing high oil prices right now. one of the reasons why we're seeing higher oil prices right now.
So Alaska was still recovering from a recession when the pandemic hit in 2020. Can you talk about where oil and gas jobs were around that time that the pandemic started, and how have jobs numbers changed since then?
Well, before the pandemic hit, we were seeing an increase in the number of oil and gas jobs. In fact, we finally broke the 10,000 mark for the first time in several years. And then when COVID hit and we lost a lot of jobs, we lost about a third of our jobs. Since then, we've had roughly an increase of about 12%. So a 12% recovery.
Got it. So when oil prices are high, does that necessarily translate to more jobs, you know, whether directly in oil and gas or in related activities?
That is a complicated question. It depends on what industry that we're talking about. If we're talking about oil and gas jobs, and it also depends on where. Oil projects in Alaska tend to be very expensive, and they tend to take a long time. And so when there's fluctuations in oil prices, it just creates more risk. And so we don't always see an immediate increase in the number of jobs, even when oil prices go up. It takes time.
What do high oil prices mean for Alaska's economy as a whole? I mean, I think there are some obvious benefits, like increased oil revenues for the state, presumably more economic activity. But at the same time, Alaskans are also feeling the effects of inflation and high gas prices at home. Is $120 a barrel crude a reason for Alaskans to get excited?
I think that might be very individual specific. It's really two sides of the same coin. So we definitely are going to see an increase in a revenue to the state itself. And then we can see that when they divvy out their funds, like in schools. But at the same time, because it's higher oil prices, we have to pay higher out of pocket for pretty much everything. It's going to take time for the benefits, but the costs are going to probably come a little bit sooner. It's a double-edged sword.
That was state economist Sarah Teal speaking to Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 45 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
This weekend, the Girdwood Forest Fair returns for the first time since 2019. The Forest Fair is a free, family-oriented event showcasing Alaska arts and crafts, music, and food. Terry Adkins, the fair's volunteer coordinator, says there will be more than 200 craft vendors.
We have pottery vendors. We have artists that are doing paintings and sculptures. We have jewelry. We have eclectic clothing styles. There is just too much to mention here.
Adkins says because parking is limited in Girdwood and RVs aren't allowed, a shuttle will run between the Diamond Center in Anchorage and the fairgrounds in Girdwood.
And the shuttle bus this year will be running all 3 days. It's $5 each way, so very affordable, safe way to get cars off of the highway, which is really great.
For the past 2 years, the COVID-19 pandemic put the fair on hold. Adkins says it's great to be able to bring people together again.
We're all very excited to be back in business here. Giving our artists a place to sell their wares is just, you know, is the route to the Forest Fair.
The Girdwood Forest Fair runs Friday through Sunday. There are still some rules which Forest Fair attendees may remember being posted at fairs before the pandemic. No dogs, no politics, no religious orders. Well, former state senator, Juneau mayor, and radio host Dennis Egan died on Tuesday at the age of 75. He was known for his fairness, gruff voice, and mischievous personality. He was well-liked by Politico's colleagues and his radio listeners. A former House Speaker called him the best curmudgeon around. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has this remembrance.
He said, "Oh, God, it's you."
That's Jesse Keel doing a pretty good impression of his former boss's signature snarl. If Egan greeted you like that, Keel says that's how you knew he liked you.
If you ever walked into his office and he said, "Oh, I'm glad you're here. Please sit down. We have things to discuss." Panic, right? He put people at ease with that gruff manner.
Keel worked for Egan when he was a Democratic state senator representing Juneau, Haines, Skagway, and Gustavus from 2009 to 2018. Keel is also Egan's immediate successor in the seat. They were still in touch, talking political gossip most Tuesdays with a group of friends. Dennis Egan was born and raised in Juneau when Alaska was a territory. His father, Bill Egan, led Alaska's Constitutional Convention in the 1950s, and in 1959 became the new state's first governor. Dennis Egan would have been 11 years old when the family moved into the governor's mansion. He was a prolific mischief maker and prankster.
Sometimes those pranks turned out to be on the front doorstep of a sitting legislator, and then, boy, his father made him make the apologies quite formally.
Egan shared several stories about his childhood in the governor's mansion with Alaska's news source in 2017, including brewing beer in the basement and running a pirate radio station in the attic. Radio turned out to be a big part of Egan's life. In the 1960s, he went to Radio Operation Engineering School and graduated from an Army Communications School. He used his radio skills serving in the Alaska Army National Guard. In the private sector, Egan worked for KINY in Juneau, eventually becoming part owner of the station and its general manager. His gravelly voice became particularly well-known in the region after hosting Problem Corner for decades. That's the station's long-running live swap meet show.
No replacing Dennis Egan on that program.
Pete Caron is a retired news director for KINY. In 1989, Egan was elected to the Juneau Assembly. He became mayor in 1995 when then-mayor Byron Mallott resigned to lead the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation.
What was really amazing is when he served as mayor and he still managed the radio station, he would be forthcoming, accessible, and still make sure that the competition, like you guys, the umpire, were treated equally, too. I didn't get exclusive because he was the mayor.
In 2009, Egan was appointed to the state Senate after the Obama administration hired away Juneau's sitting senator. In one of Egan's last public speaking engagements as an elected official in 2018, he described his philosophy for getting things done in the often deadlocked Alaska legislature.
We have to be nice to everyone. We have to work with everyone. Whether you're an R or a D or, you know, you have to get along or you don't get anything accomplished. Perfect example is $140 million for SLAM.
SLAM stands for State Libraries, Archives, and Museum, the facility in Juneau that was completed in 2016. Egan had worked for years to secure state funding for it.
You have to get along with people. That's the only way you have at least some opportunity of getting things accomplished.
At the time, Egan had announced his retirement from the Senate and joked that he could get away with saying whatever he wanted to his conservative-leaning crowd.
What can you do to me? Fire me? I love doing that.
Then he explained why he supported a statewide income tax and reducing permanent fund dividends to support state government. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Like many rural communities, Sitka struggles to keep up with its feral cat population. However, because of the island's limited genetic diversity, an interesting and somewhat rare genetic mutation has made its way into the gene pool. KCAW's Tosh Kimmel reports.
2 years ago, Anna Laffrey was out for a walk on the Sitka Cross Trail when she stumbled upon something unexpected.
I literally thought that I saw a three-headed cat, and I stopped on the sidewalk and then took a step closer into the brush, and they scattered.
It was a litter of kittens. She knew she'd have to act quickly. It was winter in Sitka, and they wouldn't last long in the elements. Eventually, with the help of some friends, she was able to capture one of them.
We used a butterfly net and a pot. Yeah, we picked her up with a jacket, and we had a big stock pot, and we kind of dropped her in the pot with blankets and took her home.
What she didn't know when she brought home that tiny, terrified kitten is that she was a carrier of a unique genetic mutation.
This is Alice. She's polydactyl. It looks like she has thumbs. She has huge paws. She can pick up a blueberry with her hand.
Put simply, cats with polydactylism are born with extra digits. In Alice's case, that means 6 toes on each front paw for a total of 20 toes. Most cats have 18. But while Alice's megamits may seem like a 1 in a million, the mutation is actually quite common here in Sitka. According to visiting veterinarian Nicole Caraway, Sitka's lack of genetic diversity makes it a perfect breeding ground for the dominant trait.
One parent has it, and the other parent doesn't, then there's a 50% chance that all the kittens that are born will have polydactyl or extra toes. So because it's a dominant trait, it is something that is basically guaranteed to be passed on. The population genetically here is smaller, so you're going to see more of that mutation.
While some may assume Sitka's mutant cat population is a result of inbreeding, Caraway says the gene can and does occur in all feline populations.
I normally work at a very busy practice in Northern California, and where animals are obviously less likely to be inbred, and I still see a great deal of it.
No one really knows how prevalent polydactylism is on the island. There's never been a study, but guesses range from 5% to a third of the population. However, according to Animal Control Officer Jim Rogers, there never seems to be a shortage of them at the local shelter. I met with Rogers at the animal shelter. On a whiteboard, he pointed out the names of all the kittens who'd recently been rescued.
Yeah, the kittens that, all of the kittens that are polydactyl have been fostered at the moment.
Oh, gotcha.
All of these guys, every single kitten is polydactyl, but they're all out right now.
Right, okay.
But I can show you, I think.
Oh, hi.
He goes in the same spot he is. Hey, buddy. How are you doing? He gets a little nervous with strangers. Hi. Can we see these paws? Can we see them without you scratching? Let's see. Can you pull this one out? See what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Oh, wow. He has a lot of toes. Yeah. Two extra ones?
Let's see, 1, 2.
While these unique felines are slinking around at a higher rate than Sitka, vet Nicole Caraway says the condition seems most common on the eastern seaboard, where they were historically kept as ship cats. It's said that sailors once believed they brought luck, and that their extra claws made them expert mousers. It's impossible to know when the first polydactyl cat made it onto the shores of Sitka, but as a town full of fishermen, it only seems right that these funky-footed cats should call this place home. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Tosh Kimmel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lex Trinan, Wesley Early, Kavitha George, and Laura Fillion in Anchorage, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, and Tosh Kimmel in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. Katie Anastas is our producer. And I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.